This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on June 1st, 2011. Tonight is Restravaganza. Tonight we're joined by Glenn Block. Glenn works at Microsoft. He's on the WCF web API, he's on the WCF team, and he's formerly known for his meth dealing, and we'll give Glenn a chance in a second to talk more about what he's been up to lately. John Sheehan works at Twilio. He also works on the award-winning Rest Sharp, grand prize winner at Mix 11, although it may have been fixed. I've got questions. And then Daryl Miller has a small software company building business applications for metal fabrication, which is interesting. Do you guys want to say a quick hi, add anything to that?
Well, I am also known for my ability to talk about the history of computing.
Yeah, what do you think?
For hours.
All right, John.
And that was the abridged version.
That was. I sped it up quite a bit. Well, to be fair, you were asked a very open-ended question. So, John, what do you got to say?
First, I want to defend my honor. I won open source fest at Mix, fair and square. I mean,
it's pretty hard unless you smuggled a bunch of chips in.
Unless I did that, which I didn't.
But I think I saw some smuggling going on. I was in that same room. As a matter of fact, he took them all off the MEF contrib tape.
I thought it was open source. They were community chips.
Right. So, Glenn, I did want to you've been on several podcasts and you've spoken a lot lately about what you're doing with WCF Web API, but it does kind of fit into the background of what we're talking about. Sure. I wondered if you could give just the 2 minute, just what are you working on with WCF lately and how that fits in with REST?
There goes the history of computing. So what I would say is that we're very serious in WCF about offering a great solution for exposing, people always laugh when I say exposing, capabilities of your systems over HTTP. And REST is as we'll hear about more in the podcast, an architectural style. It's a way to build systems over HTTP. And so Web API, I always say, is not opinionated about REST. It's opinionated about HTTP. But because building a RESTful system requires you to have a good framework for HTTP that lets you fully leverage the semantics and capabilities of HTTP, Web API giving you a great HTTP experience means that you can use it to build RESTful systems as opposed to forcing you down a path of building a RESTful system. So it's an enabler is the way I would say it.
Okay. Okay, Scott, do you have anything to add or are you just banging stuff around over there?
That's awesome. is that a cute...
What was awesome? That I finished it in like 2 minutes?
Oh, it was just very well spoken, Glenn.
Thank you.
Inspired me.
What do you think about that, Daryl?
I'm very interested in the whole WCF Web API project. I started doing REST using the older WCF bits and was a little disillusioned with what it could do for me. I come at REST from a slightly non-traditional perspective because I'm building what people would traditionally consider fat desktop applications on the old client server model, but I'm using REST. So I'm using a WinForms, rich WinForms app where users sit there day in, day out using our app. So it's not your standard web app. And my experience so far with the WCF Web API is it's going to really solve a lot of the problems that the original attempt at doing REST over WCF had. At the moment, I'm just basically using an HTTP listener and I built an infrastructure on top of that. And WCF Web API is going to address a lot of the issues that we currently have.
So, Daryl, you said you were using HTTP listener before because WCF REST toolkit wasn't good enough for your needs and maybe ASP.NET MVC wasn't out yet. I don't think a lot of people know about HTTP listener. Like, how is that working for you in the systems you're using it? Does it give you all the flexibility you need, or is there some limitation there that makes WCF Web API appealing?
It's pretty raw. I mean, you basically fire it up and it's listening on a port, and you get in a context which you can pull out a request and response headers from. There's no routing comes with it, so I had to build all the routing infrastructure myself. So the main problem that I'm seeing with it is I'm no low-level wonk, and my performance is not nearly as good as some of the tests that I've done with the web API for just streaming data across the wire. I don't know what I'm doing wrong with HTTP Listener. I mean, it's working for me, but I think I could get much better performance out of it if I knew what I was doing.
HTTP Listener is really low-level bits that forces you to do, you know, to really build a lot of infrastructure to make it work. It's nice that it's very close to the wire, but it doesn't, you know, there's a lot of things that you need to take care of to try to use it in any coherent fashion.
Yeah, I can pretty much agree with that.
So, Daryl, what made you select that type of architecture for your application? If you had to do this additional work, why not just, you know, use something that was SOAPy and just came with a tool set?
Okay. Well, I mean, I started doing integration work with our business app using AzimX. And then, you know, WCF was coming down the pike, and I said, okay, well, I'll wait till WCF comes around. And we converted to that, and then I got kind of lost in schemas and namespaces and versioning, and it just seemed a lot of hard work. And the problem with doing distributed applications using WCF is you kind of start with a blank slate. You get this service contract, and, well, you can do anything. And there's really no guidance. And I mean, I'd built client-server apps before where you had a fat client that just talked to a database, but I'd never really built distributed apps before. And there was a lot of things I didn't know what to do or didn't know how to do. So when I started to discover REST and the fact that HTTP is actually an application protocol that actually solves a lot of these problems, I was like, oh, well, okay, I'll do it that way. And as I learned more about REST, I started to learn what the benefits that a RESTful architecture brings to an application. And one of the most important for us is evolvability. We write applications that we expect our customers to be using for at least 10 years, maybe 15 years. And over that period of time, there's lots of things that are going to change. And it's the decoupling of the client and server so that the two can evolve independently. That's the main benefit that the REST architecture brings for me.
So it sounds like this is not something that you just have been doing recently. This is a path you started down several years ago?
Yeah. It's about three to four years since I started discovering REST.
Wow.
So, Glenn, you've got a question out there. I was going to kind of back up and ask kind of what is REST? What does it mean to you? And I was going to throw that at Daryl first, as John recommended, but...
Well, I was gonna jump into something more specific related to what Daryl just said. We can come back to the overall REST discussion. Is, you know, this evolvability thing, it's like the term people use is motherhood and apple pie. Like, who doesn't want evolvability in their systems? And everybody would argue that they're trying to build their systems, I think, in a way that you can take them forward, right? So I guess my question for you, Daryl, is when you say evolvability, what does that actually mean? How is it different building an evolvable system using a RESTful approach than any other approach?
Okay, well, I'll give you a real example from our app. We have part of our system is shop floor devices where guys actually use them for punching their time in and out on jobs. So there's guys walking up to these terminals day in, day out. And over a period of about 6 months, we were constantly refining the business logic of how this system collected that data, validated that data, and all these changes were happening on the server, and the clients never needed to be updated. Now, these were rich WinForms type clients. Now, my experience in the past with AzimX and WCF data contracts is if you sneezed whilst compiling, you had to recompile the client. Like, you could do anything, and you had to recompile the client. And in our scenario, to push updates onto the shop floor environment was a really painful situation. So it just allowed us, in the same way that a web app, right? You know, you have a web browser and you have a web app. Web apps are great because you can just update the stuff to the server. You can't do that, or you couldn't do that in the past with rich client-server apps. It was very difficult to only update the server portion. So that's where it benefited us.
Okay. So before going any further, we really probably should kind of go back up to a higher level and kind of say, well, what is REST and what does it mean to you? So Daryl, what does that mean? You know, in the context, especially of what you've been talking about, what does REST mean to you?
REST means to me that there's only two things that the client and server couple on. One is media types and the other is link relations. Now, that's kind of an abstract explanation, but that's, to me, what it boils down to. There's no coupling on endpoints. There's no, I don't have an API documentation that says this URL, you're going to get this response back. The only thing that the client knows about the server is the media types that it talks. And I'm not sure whether that really answers the question, but it's what it boils down to me.
Okay. Anyone have an argument with that?
Yeah, so, you know, we're trying to hire a lot of people right now at the company I work at. And so the core of our product is a REST API. So pretty much everyone I talk to on the phone, I ask, what is REST? And so I get a lot of different answers, which makes me think that there's really no understanding of this at a broad level from people. So like those of us that like are working on, you know, WCF or REST Sharp or whatever, we seem to have an understanding of it. But on a broad level, it seems like everything that Daryl just described, very few people consider anything having to do with REST.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely right. Go ahead, Daryl.
No, I agree. It's not the common opinion. That's one of the problems, is the term REST has been so abused that 95% of its usage is not what the original intent of the REST sample architecture was really all about.
So, I mean, when I first joined the WCF team about a year ago, and I had heard a lot of, you know, throwing around of the term REST when I was really involved with the alt.NET community. I'm still involved with the alt.NET community, but and the interpretation that I had for REST joining the WCF team was REST is really anything that's not SOAP that's over HTTP in a friendly fashion. And, you know, a lot of people think REST is about, you know, URIs, or there's lots of different interpretations. And it wasn't until I started to research it that I realized there really is a meaning. And I think we could start with saying, like, REST is a term that was defined by a person. His name is Roy Fielding. He authored the HTTP spec. And REST was, you know, he wrote a dissertation about network-based architecture. And he talked about REST as a style which is indicative of building systems that work well for the web. When they were designing the infrastructure of the web, they wanted to build these systems that really scaled well, that were really evolvable. But I think it's like, that's where it starts. It starts with a real definition. Even though people have taken it to mean a million other things, there actually is a source that you can go back to learn what REST is about.
So Glenn, you talked about Roy's dissertation, like, and you know that there, that is the source, the definitive version of what REST is. Where does WCF Web API fall? Compare, you know, how close is it to that definition?
I think that with WCF, well, I would say that again, WCF Web API is about HTTP. REST, in its first implementation, is about HTTP. So what I would say is that Web API, as long as Web API stays true to HTTP, then it's staying true to supporting building RESTful systems. I believe, because we've been very intentional about it, that we are coming out with something that is really good for folks that want to abide by the constraints of building RESTful systems in order to get the benefits. But, you know, Daryl has been involved pretty heavily with the effort. He can give his opinion on that matter. And no, this is not a Web API podcast.
Well, you know, while we're talking kind of about definitions and all that, obviously that for a lot of people that just the, you know, the clean URLs is enough for REST. There was something, though, we had a question from Twitter from Stephen Proctor, and he asked, isn't there something also about next available commands so that within a response I get back information about what I can respond and I can kind of navigate based on responses?
So that is known as hypermedia, and I will let Daryl talk about it.
Yeah, there's another phrase which is called follow your nose. And the idea being that the server guides the client through the options that it has available to it. And this is actually one way that you can take a lot of the logic off the client and move it onto the server, because you can make decisions on the server and only include the links that are appropriate. You take a wizard example. This is a classic, right? You display a one particular UI, and then there's a next link where the client can follow, and then they enter some more information, then there's another next, but then there's also a previous. So the response that comes back gives the options to the client, and it becomes easy to make the changes on the server to change what links are available. And as long as you build the client in a way that is not tightly coupled to the existence of that link, the client should look and say, does that link exist? Okay, then I will put that feature on the UI to the end user. And by doing that, you are able to build adaptive clients. And again, this goes back to our evolving idea.
So kind of to, you know, stir things up a bit then, there's some ill feeling towards OData from some people I talk to that really care about REST. As an application developer, it's been really handy for me because I can navigate through, I can filter server side. It's easy enough to work with. So, I mean, as a developer that's consuming OData, I'm happy enough with it. But I've heard from people that, you know, constructing RESTful services, they have some real issues. We had Seb Lambla on a while ago, and he was not really very happy with OData. But then as you're talking about, you know, navigable services and so what is it that gets to the core of why people that care about REST dislike the way OData is implemented? You want to start, Daryl?
Sure. I'll give you an example. How would you feel if you went to if you were told to go to a website, but there was no homepage to that website? It would be pretty difficult to get there.
Would there be a long intro?
Who knows? The point is if you have, I mean, one of the kind of guiding principles of a REST API is that there should be one root URL and you find everything from there. OData breaks that cardinal rule. You can get to the service, but you can't get to the metadata. You can't get to the EDMX definition by following a link. You can't get to, I've got to remember all of the different, the payload is just arbitrarily described as application/XML. There's a few things about it that they didn't quite do right. There's no way of knowing what kind of query string I'm allowed to build. I believe with a few minor additions and a few additional links to OData, you could fill in those gaps. And I think the majority of the REST people would be pretty happy with it.
Can I just, from my use of it, just to clarify what I'm misunderstanding, I think that I can get metadata about a service by putting dollar metadata at the end. You know, I browse the service and I hit dollar metadata. And I think that I'm able to, if I browse to, you know, the root service, then it's going to show me a list of entities and I can splunk through those. And one other thing that I think is that the OData protocol specifies the filters and the different ways that I can navigate through. So what have I missed there?
Okay, so here's the first thing is you can't follow a link to get to the metadata, right? You have to know how to construct the URI.
Okay.
It's a trivial little thing. It would be so easy to add, right? But you can't follow a link. Second thing is when you go to an OData endpoint, what's the media type that comes back?
XML. Is it?
It's an atom.
Yeah.
It's atom, right? How do I know whether I'm accessing an atom endpoint or whether I'm accessing an OData endpoint? How do I know whether I can do that queries, those really clever filters and tops and all of those different things? I don't.
I see.
Right? So you've got two choices. Either you create a new media type called OData plus XML, right? Which all of a sudden is a little unfortunate because now feed readers can't read it. Or you do the open search type of approach, where you create a link, rel equals search, and you point to a specification that says, this is the OData way of querying. By adding that extra little link, you've made the message self-descriptive, and now all of a sudden the client can look at that response it gets back, and it knows whether or not that endpoint supports that querying mechanism or not.
Okay.
Did that? Yeah.
So I'll weigh in here. I think that on one level, you could say that regardless how good or how bad OData is, and I'm not saying it's bad at all, that HTTP itself is completely open. OData takes a constrained view over HTTP. Constraints are not necessarily a bad thing. Like when you use Astoria Data Service, you know, WCF Data Services or codename Astoria, you get a lot out of the box, you know, when you work with data services, which is really built on OData. You know, it is a delivery mechanism for OData. People also often confuse that as well. They think OData is a technology when OData really is just a format. It's a URI format, and there's also a representation format in Atom or in JSON, which is kind of like an Atom feed in JSON. But the point, I think, is that you hit a ceiling. Like, it's great for some scenarios, for a lot of scenarios. I mean, it's a, you know, and what are the goals? I mean, the real goals for OData was to provide this really rich data querying language over HTTP. But I think the point is there's lots of apps that don't fall in that category. So without, you know, giving a verdict, and I think there are a lot of people that are finding success with OData. I mean, whether it's RESTful or not by the term at the end of the day doesn't matter. Does it help companies to deliver business value and make money? That's really where the important thing is with this whole discussion. I think what the important thing about REST is that if you have certain types of systems that have certain constraints, like they're really large systems with many clients where you need everything to be highly evolvable, then REST is an answer. OData has a set of constraints. It has a fixed kind of schema associated with it, a fixed URI scheme. There's a whole bunch of things it sets down, but it does that for a reason. It does that in order to deliver you an end-to-end experience. So my opinion on OData is that it is one great answer to solve a set of problems, but it's not by any means the only answer. And I'll give you a perfect example. There are other media types other than OData. There are thousands of them. I talked about this in my mix talk. If you don't understand those other media types, you can't work with systems that exist that, you know, if you only understand the things that, you know, the OData protocol. So I think the world is vast, and a subset of that world, look, you know, we'll use OData as a solution, and that's fine, but there's tons of other solutions out there that it might not be ideal for. And Web API, I could say we're looking to be that gap filler that says that, look, whatever you want to do with HTTP, you don't have to use our fixed format. You can do whatever you want. I hope that clarifies.
Wait, did you say gap filler or yak shaver? So, and Glenn doesn't have to answer this. In fact, Glenn should not answer this because he works directly for Microsoft. So I guess that leaves you out too, John. Wah, wah, wah. But can anyone else
on
the podcast...
Wait, John Sheehan joined Microsoft? What's going to happen to Rest Sharp?
Hey, wait.
Microsoft's killing Rest Sharp.
Yeah, so you're having a meeting on next Monday about Web API and Rest Sharp, Glenn, just in case you didn't know.
I can add that to the list of meetings for us.
So can anyone else on the podcast name off, I'm going to say, three OData feeds that aren't examples?
Netflix.
One?
Netflix.
Two?
The mix videos.
Mix videos. That's borderline.
You guys are missing a big
yeah,
one.
I realize.
But we're kind of scraping the bottom here.
What
yeah,
happened
see?
To Dallas? Dallas had a whole bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
Codename Dallas?
I mean, I'm gonna break the restriction that Scott put on me.
Well, yeah, John may have...
The main one that I think of is NuGet. The whole NuGet feed system, the NuGet tooling that's built into Visual Studio, that all works off of OData feeds.
Hmm. Again, kind of borderline because, yeah, it's using OData, but it's built by Microsoft. So.
All right. So I will weigh in on this. Whether there's I think if we had the OData team on here, they would tell you about lots of feeds that are out there. But I would say that I talk to a lot of customers that are really interested in exposing their information with OData for this reason. The one thing the OData team has done that's fantastic is they've built clients for almost every platform you can think of. And it provides a standard way to exchange data. So the combination of having a standard way to exchange information, a ton of clients for every device that's out there practically, means it offers a really simple, cheap way for customers that want to expose their information to an ecosystem of tools and other things that exist to be able to do it.
So,
but doesn't every platform parse JSON?
But it doesn't. But JSON is just, here's the problem. JSON is very loose. It doesn't mean anything. OData gives meaning. The meaning it gives in this case is, hey, there are these entities and there's this data. Now, when you look at other media types that are out there, I mean, you take Atom. Atom is a feed. It has semantics associated with it. One of the types, media types I've talked about is vCard. That says I'm an electronic contact. JSON is just something that's parsable. XML is just something that's parsable. You know, try throwing XML at a system that understands a particular media type that may use XML as the data, as the representation, the transport format, and you will see it blow up because all it means is you can throw me to a parser and do something with it. OData, however, means anybody can walk up to an OData feed as long as they understand the OData semantics, and they can make heads or tails out of the types of information they're getting. Now, true, the information that they're getting is more modeled off of data. I get back a customer, I get back an order. I still have to know what that customer and that order are. And that's where having richer media types changes the equation. Because, for example, when I use text/directory, which is a vCard, if I read that spec, it's not about data. It's about an electronic business card. It has much richer meaning from a domain-specific standpoint.
So, sure, but can't you just set the accept header and yet have that drive what you get back? So if you're asking for a vCard, maybe we need an accept header.
But what's that got to do? True, but the conversation was around JSON.
Well, so,
JSON is just characters.
Well, so is OData in that case.
No, but OData
because if
has
you're if you're setting a media type and you're telling it, okay, this is going to be a vCard, are you really using OData?
The difference is
that
if you
just
go to,
blew my mind. I can't answer.
If you go to the OData spec, it will point you to the AtomPub spec, which will tell you that there is an entry element that has a title, it has a last modified, it has an authored by. You can get some real valid information. If you go to the JSON spec, it doesn't tell you squat about
exactly.
What is in. There's nothing about what
XML
is in the data.
XML spec, the same thing. But go to the HTML spec and you see something very different. You know, I have this thing called button, and the semantics of a button is it will render as a button. It's a completely different ball of wax.
Right. John Sheehan, you've been waiting.
Either way, you need to have some predefined knowledge. You either have to have OData's spec. You either have to know that, or you have to know the schema of the data you're getting back just over regular HTTP. So really, like, OData is not really removing any major, like, you know, having an OData client doesn't still forgive you for, or, you know, let you get away with not knowing stuff ahead of time.
You know stuff, but you know less because, for example, I mean, you have semantics expressed with OData that you don't get with XML. XML, it's like, yeah, you could give me a schema, but that schema just says validation and structure. It doesn't really doesn't know about things like relationships. OData expresses relationships. Atom also, right? Mm-hmm. The notion of linking and things like that. It's a much richer, and if you think about content types and media types, so if I return you something that says text/vCard, I've now given you the information you need to be able to discover, like going to IANA, what that means. I can search in Google text/directory and say, oh, that's a business card. So I get a discoverability there that I don't get with just XML. With OData, same thing. I do get a discoverability, like I know that this has namespaces and other stuff related to OData, then I can look that up and get some better understanding about how to work with this.
One of the $100 phrases of REST is serendipitous reuse, which doesn't mean that I'm planning to reuse this API. It means that there is some reuse that occurs that I wasn't planning for. And if you happen to put out an OData feed, I can happen to come along with my Outlook RSS feed reader and read it. If you put out a JSON or XML feed, I can't. So the idea is that by using more commonly known media types and taking advantage of those existing ones, we get to leverage existing clients without having to write clients specifically for a particular service, because that's what we're trying to get away from. We don't want to keep writing more clients with a one-to-one relationship with services. Clients should consume media types, and services should expose media types.
But Daryl, along those lines, I see that that as a utopia too, where, you know, we should be writing less clients and just have smarter client that understands more. But is that really possible, like, or practical, really? Like, is that somewhere we're actually going to get someday?
Well, we will find out. Little plug here, the RestFest event that's going to happen in August. One of the Hack Day sessions that we're going to have is there is a spec that has been defined as an example that just defines application semantics. And we're going to have people submit, write clients and servers independently, and then try and get them to talk to each other. So this will be an attempt to prove the fact that you can get interoperability based purely on a common semantics defined within a media type. So I think it is feasible.
I think there's the ideals that REST offers, which is, you know, I think the technology is not there yet, but maybe that technology will come. You know, this idea of autonomous clients that can simply take, you know, and there's this attempt to do some type of description some way, you know, starting with a spec, but maybe in the future having an electronic way, which John is asking about. But I think there's very real benefits that you can get by not looking at it from that angle, but simply looking at it at the angle of, look, I can have multiple versions of clients working together with the same system at the same time. And that doesn't need me to have autonomous clients. That needs me to have clients that are designed in a way that they're less prone to breakage. And that requires the server to offer up information in a way that allows those clients to be adaptable. So it's on both sides of the coin. But as an example, you know, we could look at HTTP, look at HTTP 1.0 and HTTP 1.1. And that's an example of where they introduced some significant changes into HTTP in 1.1, but older servers still were able to operate with newer clients and vice versa. So, and that was because of the way those clients were designed. And things like using hypermedia is one aspect, using linking, that allows clients to ignore links they don't know. So I think it's, you know, the very real possibility is to say that although there's this utopian idea of clients that magically evolve, there's a much closer reality of just having different versions of clients able to operate on the same system at the same time. And REST brings that.
So, you know, the whole idea of different media types and metadata and all that. One thing this reminds me, and maybe they're just similar but completely separated, but the idea of microformats, and you know, that's a way of kind of slapping semantics on top of HTML. So you say, if you know, if this div is named contact and it has these other divs inside it, we're going to assume that this is, you know, a person or whatever. Is there that kind of approach? Is there any kind of approach that's similar to that for you know, a RESTful discussion, or is that just completely different?
I think that's a perfectly valid approach. There's a couple of minor little niggles with it, but the ALPS application profile semantics that I was talking about that we're going to be doing at RESTFest is very, very similar to the way microformats works. It's just a little bit more well-defined. But no, that's a very reasonable way of doing it.
Yeah, I think they're orthogonal because microformats are really taking some data and using almost like some conventions that certain elements have certain meaning. I mean, link in many ways is becoming like a standard way to represent hypermedia, that whatever XML representation you have, you throw a link in there, you know what it means. And semantic web is all about, you know, and doing microformats is all about having standardized ways of representing things, but where the entire piece of data or information that you're looking at is not the thing that you're talking about when you're talking about microformats. You're saying that subsets of that data have their own meaning that is altogether separate from the entirety of the piece of data being shown, like the friend of a friend example. Right, I could have
so by
some
link,
data.
By link, you mean L-I-N-K, not L-I-N-Q, right?
L-I-N-K.
Okay, because I got confused with
L-Y.
Not
L-Y-N-C, right?
None of those.
So this is all kind of interesting, and I'm gonna jump in here because this is kind of related to discoverability and relationalness of things on the web. Anyone want to talk about RDF's role kind of in this world?
The whole world is triples. That's all.
Does anyone here speak RDF fluently?
I have an opinion on RDF. I don't think too many people share it, but the whole, I think linked data and REST try and solve two different problems. Linked data is very much about describing relationships between data and is most useful for scripted types of processes, batch processing, that will crawl that data and determine secondary pieces of information from it.
Like building a data warehouse, for example.
For possibly. REST is much more about application workflow, and it's about guiding the user through a sequence of steps and accepting data and reading and writing. Linked data to me is much more about just a static representation of data that you go and you mine for information. So I think RDF is a very useful format, but I think it is more suited for linked data than it is for REST.
Daryl hit on a really important point, which is about this workflow. You know, there's a lot of people, when they look at REST, they think REST is about CRUD, because they map the HTTP methods and say, ooh, you know, get maps to select, put maps to update, delete maps to, well, delete, and post maps to insert. Or, you know, if I'm using an entity model, or if I'm using a domain model, I'm using some kind of framework like nhibernate, that might be like adding an entity to a repository, et cetera. But the reality of it is when you take resources are arbitrary. And when we say that word resource, you know, if you look at what does the term URL or URI mean, it's an acronym that has that R word in there. And that R means resource. And a resource can be anything. So resources can be representative of components in a business process. And if I combine that with hypermedia, which is links that help drive the navigation, because today when we build RPC-based services, we don't have a notion of navigation. An RPC, or remote procedure call-based API, is where I have a static view of an object. I have to know what methods to call. There's no implicit ordering built in an RPC. Like, think about SOAP, in a SOAP-based contract. But with REST, and when we start to get into things like linking, you know, I can create an order and the server can offer me the links that make sense for me based on the state of that order. So there's a logical, there's a state machine. I don't mean a state machine as in necessarily something like Windows Workflow Foundation, which has a state machine, though it could be that. But there's a logical state machine that guides clients through those next steps. And with that type of model, you can really apply really complicated business processes in a RESTful, you know, you can deliver complicated business processes in a RESTful way. And a lot of people, when they look at REST, they completely miss that angle. And a lot of the folks that are really interested in REST, that is one of the really interesting parts about building a RESTful system and the benefits. Did I lose everybody, or does that make sense?
All right. Okay, so there's lots of REST-ish, REST-like sorts of systems, you know, out on the network, REST-y APIs, but that veer away from REST in you know, sort of pure REST in some ways. And I'm curious on your perspective, your guys' perspective on what are the places where people lose the REST path, and what is sort of the, you know, what is the cardinality of the sins? Like, what are the really important things to maintain, and some things that are you know, less important?
I think a guy named Aristotle, I'm going to kill his second name. I don't even know his second name. He's on the REST discuss list. He said once that the hypermedia constraint is the one constraint that brings all the others together and makes REST bigger than the sum of all of them. And REST, the hypermedia constraint, is the part that most people don't do. And I think one of the reasons for that is there's very few examples out there that show you how to do that on the client, how to consume hypermedia services. Most people who look at REST services that do have hypermedia go, oh my God, I don't want to have to follow all these links, and I have to go from here to here to here to here to here to be able to get this one little piece of information. And it seems cumbersome and painful. And it is a little cumbersome, but you get benefits from it, and it's not as bad as it looks. But I think not doing the linking And what Glenn was saying is just trying to expose a bunch of CRUD endpoints and basically doing stored procedures over HTTP. I think that's the biggest failing when people try and do REST APIs.
And I think we, can I just clarify one thing? I think we got to point out here clearly that you don't have to build RESTful systems. Like, you should build RESTful systems if that makes sense. Where the other concern, the concern I think is when people build systems that are obviously not RESTful and they call them RESTful. And that's, you know, that's like just calling, you know, that's like taking a factory pattern and saying, oh, that's, you know, I don't know, that's a builder. I mean, it causes confusion. It also gives people false perceptions. And it doesn't help those that are trying to really build systems that are, you know, that are catering to the constraints of REST.
Back to Daryl's point about, you know, nobody's put out any examples about how to consume, you know, a truly RESTful API. I don't think it's so much a matter of not understanding it how to technically do it, but nobody, and I live REST, I'm in REST constantly, has yet to like really demonstrate well the benefits of doing it that way. All it sounds like is academia for most people.
I disagree with you. John Moore, who's a technical fellow at Comcast, go watch his talk at Oradev. He demonstrates very clearly benefits that were that building such a system provided.
Yep.
For the systems that Comcast was building.
Right. So we've got one example that seems to be the one that everybody refers to is this talk. And I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, and I want to, and it sounds good. But again, this is like one example. What we need are a lot of examples of people driving benefits from using these types of systems, not just one big company or one implementation. That's what's going to get momentum behind, you know, moving more and more towards a pure REST endpoint. Once people have that pattern repeated of here are the benefits that I'm going to get from going to do this.
Well, you know, talking about business value, I know one thing, Glenn, that you talked about in your mix talk was you showed presentation that fit on different platforms, including, you know, iPad or whatever, you know, based on what the client accepted and using REST or using WCF web APIs to support that. Is that an example of a business value proposition for this?
Definitely, because when you model things as resources, and resources can support different representations, then based on the needs of the client, you can cater that representation. And HTTP provides a very clean way of doing that, that, you know, that is defined as opposed to having to invent some new thing that, you know, third parties may or may not understand. But I want to get back to what John was saying. I think there's truth in what John is saying in the sense that, you know, in the past, everything that was RESTful was handled by our browser. We didn't have to think about it. What's happening is, you know, we're seeing this move of building systems over HTTP that want to leverage the benefits that HTTP provides, like scale and evolvability, that browsers have always benefited from. But because we're moving beyond the browser, suddenly lots of these concerns are in our face that we didn't have to deal with. And that then puts the burden back on, well, what kind of platform support do we get for building such systems? And I think today there are some solutions, but it hasn't been really strong. There are definitely some things that are coming. They're strong. There are things like OpenRasta, one example. There's examples in Java, but it's still very young. And so, you know, one of the things I think that's an opportunity for Microsoft with Web API is by making it easier for people to build these types of systems, and not to say we're the only ones that do it, but there is power in the sense that we have a pretty big market of people that are following the stuff that we're doing. And, you know, I've noticed even over the past year that since we've been trying to talk about REST and the values of REST, there's a lot more buzz in the traditional Microsoft community. People are talking about it more, wanting to understand it. So I think that, you know, the work we're doing with Web API is going to help that along. And we're also working on samples with people like Daryl to help illustrate how people can take advantage of this. Plus, working with lots of customers that I can't talk about now that are engaged in building such systems. But I agree with Daryl. I mean, I agree with John. There's not a lot of great examples right now.
Here's another example that people may argue with me, but I think it's an interesting scenario. Remember a little while ago, Twitter complained about all the people developing different clients for their API and how there was an inconsistency in the way that they worked and it was confusing end users.
Is that before they bought all the clients and shut everybody down?
Yeah.
So here's a theory, right? Instead of exposing kind of RPC endpoints that don't define any workflow, you actually defined a real REST API that had hypermedia and workflow that defined at each point in the workflow what the user could do. Then you get people who write a client for Android, a client for the iPhone, a client for Windows Phone 7. If they follow that same workflow, there is a much more common experience that the end user is going to get. Yeah, okay, the end user, the end device, the native app can add little bits of prettiness on top, but the basic workflow becomes the same. So one, you've reduced the amount of effort that the end developer who's creating that client has to do. You still have a nice little native app, and you've created consistency across those clients.
So we've said that there's not a lot of great examples. Are there any public RESTful APIs that you guys would point to as, you know, like here is the best example of an API that, you know, follows the principles and, you know, does the right things? You know, we've got Twitter, obviously, isn't it? We've got Netflix. We've got...
Sun's cloud hosting API is quite good. And there's also another hosting API called Steam Cannon that has some quite good documentation on their API. I haven't actually used them, but they seem to take a pretty good approach to building a RESTful system.
The most prevalent best example of building a RESTful system is Atom. The Atom Pro, you know, Atom Pub is prevalent everywhere. And that is a REST-based, you know, that is a media type and a protocol that adheres to RESTful constraints. And you see the benefit that tons of clients... How many different blog readers do you have? No, Atom is not read-only because you can post, you know, you can add new posts, etc. So, I mean, now it is a specific semantic around blogging, but the point is, think about the broadness of clients that are able to work with Atom feeds and blogging sites.
Okay, Scott, you still got a question?
I just wanted to ask about building clients. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about, I think, the server side of things. But, you know, when Daryl's talking about workflow and Glenn's talking about browsers have been supporting REST for a long time, but, you know, browsers are operated by humans. You can find links and figure out what to click on. Still seems to me that there's a big challenge in building clients for this stuff, too.
Oh, I definitely agree. I mean, building clients is difficult, and there are not very many examples of that too. But I think even when you are building a rich client, a desktop app or a phone app, I still think it should be human driven in the same way as a browser works. I don't think there really needs to be a lot of logic to fully take advantage of a REST API. And I don't think there should be a lot of logic on the client.
I think one thing that is, you know, automated, and, you know, Glenn, you explained this to me early on, but the whole content negotiation thing is really cool because, like, if you think back to, you know, like, one approach to giving different content to different people is you say, oh, this looks like a mobile browser, so I'm going to give them the crap version. Oh, this looks like this thing, so, this is this system, so I'm going to give them this.
You're talking about the user agent.
Exactly. Look, and the whole user agent sniffing thing is annoying because really it should be the client saying, here's what I want. Here's the list of things I want in the order I want them. And you provide me, you know, you provide me what you've got out of that list. And, you know, I mean, that's such a better solution to this kind of thing.
I think where some people, me included, have an issue or might have an issue with hypermedia driving the interaction is so you've got some user interface, and this goes back to, I think, some of K. Scott's points here. You have a user interface, and that is going to represent most likely some specific task flow or, you know, some specific kind of visual interaction that a user can have. And that's not necessarily going to be, you know, some generalized thing that can be read by a list of links in some, you know, XML document that's returned by the REST service.
I kind of disagree. I do, if I can I answer? Is it open?
Yeah.
I disagree. I think that when I go to Yahoo.com or Bing or Google or whatever it is, right, that's changing all the time. That portal page that I get changes all the time. I'm a human being, though, so I can recognize that there's some new link here that's a, you know, that because that link will get represented, say, with an image or like click here to see some new special thing. There are ways to do that electronically. So when you think about linking, how many URIs have you memorized? When you browse MSDN, you know, my Howard Durking, my coworker, said there's 65,000 or some number MSDN pages. And I don't know how many people have looked at any of those MSDN documentation links, but they're just scary. Nobody memorizes those. They navigate around to find them. Well, in the same way, you wouldn't know by the link, by the URI, what you were looking at. That's why links have at least two components. They have a URI and they have a rel. And that rel defines the relationship. So that rel says, this is something interesting. That rel says to you, hey, you want to create an order. Well, maybe this rel is, you know, create or something like that. So there's a richness that's expressed with those links. It's not just about the URIs. And that's what allows the clients. And there's a spec that defines what those links mean. So somebody can still write code based on that spec that knows to look for those links. And if those links are present, it can follow them. If those links are not present, it can't follow them. So if you exposed an API in C# that had a method that retrieved a link and that link wasn't present, well, it would return you null. Or if you went further and tried to make a method that invoked that link automatically under the hood, well, it would have to get designed to say that that link might not be present. But the advantage then was new links could get added without affecting that client at all. Furthermore, the advantage is that because the client doesn't know those URIs, the server can decide and the server can evolve and repoint the client wherever it wants it to go, because all the client knows about is that rel. Just like when you browse Bing, all you know about is that link that says shop. You don't know where it points to. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, so if I can say it in another way, it may be fine that the client, you know, is expecting some, you know, some named link to be there, and they can look that up if it's there. And if it is, you know, hook that up to some button that the user presses, and when they press that button, navigate to that URL. So that's not like that's not violating REST in any way, because it's assuming something about the structure of the document.
It's saying, but those links are conditional. They may or may not be present. That's the key. And new links may show up that client doesn't know about. The problem when you have the contract model, like in SOAP, is that, you know, that contract is a fixed snapshot. That code that's generated. It's not really evolvable. There are ways you can do some things to evolve it, but it's not really evolvable in the same way. And you're highly coupled in the sense of you know where the server is. When I do add service reference, I've added that reference to that web server. If anybody wants to change the location of that service, my client is broke. But as long as I'm following a link, I can get sent to a different place and my client won't be affected.
Okay, so we're getting towards the end of the show. What I'd like to do is ask a few questions from Twitter, because we got some really good questions, if that's all right. Are we okay with wrapping that up there? Okay, so we got a question from Kelly Summers, and she asked, she's curious how REST fits in with an application that's wanting to store events and use event sourcing. Is REST common for this?
Well, I can sort of address that from the client side of things, is that a client that is accessing the REST API can send commands, as in the CQRS type of architecture, by just embedding links in the representation that represent the commands. So if a user is looking at a customer profile and they want to indicate that this customer has changed their address and moved to a new location, they can edit the address and then press a button which follows a link that has a particular rel, and on the server side, a corresponding command that corresponds to that rel can be created. So that's one way that you can deal with commands. On the event side of things, one technique that I use quite a lot on our desktop app is, in order to communicate back to the server the changes that a user has made, what we actually do is we catch UI events and aggregate them into a document and then post those back. So I'm literally saying, the user changed this text box value. The user pressed this button. The user changed this drop-down list. And we aggregate those into a list of events send them back to the server to a processing resource, and that processing resource replays those events and applies them to the domain model. So those are just two ways.
And I can talk about the reverse side, which is the server side, because when you're dealing with, you know, when you're dealing with these event-driven architecture, often you have publication where the server's pushing things out, or where different servers are communicating to one another in a decoupled fashion. And the way that tends to get implemented, now there are new things on the rise, like WebSockets, which really does a push, but the trade-off with WebSockets is it forces resources on the server to be taken up to know about who that client is so it can contact it. But the way traditionally systems will handle these kinds of notifications is actually through polling, not through a push model. And the advantage of the polling, especially if you have a large number of folks that are waiting for those notifications, is that there's lots of servers out there on the web that will help you, that will offload that destination server that you're trying to hit. And there are other benefits that HTTP provides, like utilizing e-tags for caching that allows you to minimize the amount of traffic that you're, you know, the amount of, the cost of doing this continual polling. But you get this, the net result of, you know, when something occurs, people find out about it very quickly. Now, there's some latency in polling for sure. So, you know, there are, REST is not useful for everything. I've talked to customers that want to build these real-time systems where it's like, look, I've got people that can't be in the room to take part in some type of transaction. And when they hit the button that says like buy, I want that instantly to be registered on the server, you know, and in those kind of scenarios, polling may not be the best way to go, or to let them know, like, the price has changed. I want them to know instantly the price has changed. It may be worth it to me to pay for the resource of having to hold that list of customers that want to know so I can push to them directly rather than having poll. But it really depends on the scenario.
Okay. We had one other good question from Twitter, which was from Jeff Sogoloff, and he asked about REST in the enterprise and some specific questions are securing REST services with SAML or OAuth, impersonation, that kind of thing. This was, I've run into a little bit of this too. I worked on an app recently, mostly kind of a demo app, but it's a phone app where it's consuming services and it needs some sort of, you know, authentication. What do you guys see for that? How is that handled? Where is it there yet? Is it still in need of some work?
Daryl?
The problem is that the right answer is to punt on that because REST has nothing to do with authentication, really. It's an orthogonal issue. The question is, can you do authentication in HTTP? And yeah, there are various ways of doing it, but it's not really... REST doesn't really say anything about it other than saying that you should authenticate on every request so that you maintain a stateless interaction.
But HTTP does define known headers and things like that. There is a protocol for how you address security when you're building systems over HTTP.
Absolutely.
And REST is about conforming to, you know, the uniform interface and the standard sets of headers and other things like that. But I agree with Daryl that, you know, whether doing authentication itself, you can do authentication, though, in ways that violate REST by pushing a lot of, you know, how you, depending on how you handle state management and things like that.
So the whole, you know, like the original way WCF worked, there was a lot of support for things like secure messaging and tunneling and protocols and all that, where you could say, I'm passing this message, but you can only read this part and you can only read this part. Is that still orthogonal to REST?
No, I would say that's not. I would say, what I would say is that violates REST. You know, we had a meeting early on when we first started this project with a bunch of customers, and it's like, you know, the value of using HTTP is having clients that all they understand is HTTP and they can work with that payload, so to speak. As soon as you get into message level security, you're now knocking out clients. You're restricting your clients from being able to, you're also restricting intermediaries from being able to help you. So I think that message level security is an anti-pattern for building RESTful systems. Transport level security, however, with HTTPS is, you know, the recommended way to go, because that is a natural part of the infrastructure of the web. The problem with message level security is none of the servers out there on the web understand it. My server may understand it. And you know, let's say I want to be able to talk to a browser. How's that browser going to handle something that's encrypted with message level security? I'm now adding burden to what is the client stack. Let's say I'm on a crappy phone. How's that phone going to handle message level security? So I think that, I don't think REST has anything to say about it, but I think building things with using message level security is not RESTful.
The only thing I would say about that is surely it's not unreasonable to encrypt or sign the actual payload itself. That's not going to cause too many difficulties with intermediaries, because if I send some custom media type, the intermediaries aren't going to know how to process that either. So there shouldn't be any issue with applying like XML signature or XML encryption to a payload if you want to do that. It just becomes a function of the media type.
Why would you encrypt the payload versus using SSL or some other secure transport to encrypt the entire transaction?
Oh, no, I wouldn't. I'm just saying that
Okay.
Transport level is definitely a better option. I'm just saying you can't rule out. Well, isn't there the whole issue of end-to-end? Because HTTPS is only like a point-to-point type thing. Mm-hmm. If you actually encrypted the payload itself, that payload could then be transferred through other components until it gets to its final destination, and only then it would be decrypted.
Well, that's the goal. That's the goal for like integration scenarios where servers have to communicate with one another, because the message gets to the other side, and if it's not encrypted, then it's completely open for anybody to read it.
The one other thing I've heard for this, and I heard it more just theoretically described rather than used, was the idea that you could pass a message and it would say, you know, here's a whole bunch of information. This one part contains sensitive data that only an administrator can see, but somebody else can approve this purchase because it's under this amount, you know, that kind of thing. And so this message can flow through, and it's, you know, there's different security applied at different levels, but that seems like that kind of overcomplicates a more real.
Yeah, it seems like that would be more of a function of the two systems communicating. So here's one part of the payload that, you know, this system can read, but these systems can't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's another part that everyone can read, and here's one that responds to, what am I trying to say, has to be approved by system Y or something.
The challenge you have there, I think, is the broadness of clients. You know, I'll just differ with Daryl here, which is that you are, you know, REST is really about having really rich reach in terms of the clients. And as soon as you put imposition on encryption and decryption in messages, that is now a significant impactor to which clients are going to be able to consume you or be able to send information. I can't just post to you anymore because I have to post to you information that's encrypted. What if my device doesn't support that? Well, then I'm just not locked out. I agree with what Daryl's saying, though, that if you have a media type that specifies that's the rules of the game, you could do that. I'm just, I tend to believe that transport level security is enough, should be a pivot factor for thinking about building RESTful systems.
You're right. Message level encryption, payload level encryption does prevent serendipitous reuse of my payroll data.
Okay. I think we should probably wrap up at this point.
So you mean another hour left?
Yeah. We should start winding down. So everyone, you know, catch your breath for the next hour. Do we have any huge points that we completely missed, or do you guys feel like this?
Well, what do you guys think? I mean, John.
Yeah, you know, I mean, my thought was, and I talked briefly to Kevin beforehand, but we're not REST experts. I'll speak for myself here, but you know, I mean, we wanted to get you guys on to have an interesting discussion, and I think we did. So, I
dream of having REST endpoints rather than just file drops into servers that I have to parse.
I think the real question is, are we just getting into a lot of philosophical debate with one another, or are we making ground in terms of clarifying differences between systems that are RESTful versus those that are not?
And I think the bottom line is, are people solving problems with an API, even if it's incorrectly labeled REST? And if they are, then I don't care what the API is called. It's working for them. They're getting their problem solved. They're creating value for their businesses. And if it happens to be incorrectly labeled REST, then so be it. I mean, there's a lot of words out there that get thrown around incorrectly. I mean, cloud, REST. I mean, you could go on and on. We're in a tech, in an industry full of mislabeled and misappropriated terms for things. So I don't want to ever argue over then what something is called if it's working for somebody.
Remember
my point was not
Windows 2000 and Windows ME?
No. And my point was not that. My point was there are benefits, you know, regardless of what you call what you have today, there's an architectural style, let's call it, you know, I don't know, Zubamba, that provides a bunch of benefits. And regardless of what you call what you've built, my point is to get people to think about different ways to build systems in order to gain benefit. And if the benefits are not necessary, then don't change the way you're building your systems. If you're not feeling pain, you don't have to go and turn around and build a RESTful system. Build it if it makes sense.
The only thing I would add to that is I think there is value to understanding what are the benefits a full-on fielding-style REST can bring. And if people choose that that's not appropriate for their scenario, then don't do it. But I think there's value to understanding what those benefits are.
Agreed. Yeah, I completely agree with you, Daryl.
And that was my point.
Now I see we all three agree at one point, so I think that's a good point to stop.
What I want to know about is fielding Zubamba.
Right. I know there's a Kinect game named Zumba, so maybe there's some sort of synergy. Okay. Do you guys have anything, any speaking engagements, anything coming up, anything else you'd like to talk about?
I'd like to pimp RESTfest again, August 18th to the 20th. It's a community event, and we're currently working out what we're actually going to be doing there. It's in Greenville, South Carolina.
Is there a URL for it?
RESTfest.org.
Awesome. Is it a RESTful? No, I'm not going to go into that. John, you got anything coming up?
Yeah, so in August, I'll be speaking at DevLink on RESTsharp, I think. I don't remember what that talk was about, but it'll be something about RESTsharp. And then I have another talk there too. I'm doing a really good job of pimping my stuff. I don't remember what any of it is. And then I'll be speaking at Monospace on using a bunch of APIs that call themselves RESTful and maybe aren't in various Mono apps. And then also the API Hack Weekend coming up next weekend in San Francisco with companies like OpenTalk, Boxnet, and a couple others. That's at Happy Hack, shoot, I suck at this.
I even warned you ahead of time.
Happyhack.com, HAPIHack.com. And that is free. And Foursquare and PayPal are on there as well. And let's see, I think that's all for now.
All right. Glenn, you got anything coming up?
I might be. So a bunch of people from my team were all raiding Portland Code Camp. And I might give a talk. I currently was not planning to give one, but I might give one. And the next one in my lineup is I'm going to be going to Bellingham, Ryan Riley, who worked on Frack, which is like a F-sharp port of Rack, and Frank. He's going to, he has a user group there, which I'll be speaking at, which will be sometime in June, I think like June 8th or something. And after that, the next one is going to be PDC. So I'm taking a break.
Oh, wait a minute. It's not PDC.
Wait a minute.
Oh,
His implant is not RESTful, so he didn't get the message correctly.
Right. And since it's all caps, I think you have to say it like, build.
Build. Right. I will be at build. Yes, my e-tag. The e-tag wasn't, I didn't get the latest e-tag or something.
We need to add the echo on that, too. Right.
The second talk I'll be doing at DevLink is on webhooks, which is sort of like reverse APIs in a way. So if you're interested in reverse APIs, go to DevLink and we can talk about webhooks.
I love the webhooks. Okay. All right. Well, that's all the time we have tonight on Herding Code. Thank all you guys so much for showing up. And this has just been really interesting. You can say cool. Yeah, anything.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Daryl.
Blah, blah, blah. Thanks for joining, John.
All right.
That was the sheet.
Oh.
Yeah, thanks, Glenn.
So you're not going to thank Daryl?
Of course I'll thank Daryl. Daryl, great job.
Daryl is.
We gonna thank Glenn.
I really want to thank Kevin.
Good night, Kevin.
Good night. Good night, John boy.
We need to thank Queen Beatrix.
That's
too.
True. And on that,
note... has she been outed yet? Has she been out? Not outed. Ousted.
No, no. She's still our sponsor.
Was there a bloodless coup?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Good night, folks.
So are you going to cut this thing out? Or
what you don't know is that the recording actually ended like an hour and 15 minutes.
Nice.